Welcome to the Entertainment Engine.
Hi, I'm Pete Moore.
And my name's Bex Gregory. And together we are the co-hosts of the Entertainment Engine podcast. We are really excited to share more information about our show.
The podcast is for new and existing creatives working in music, film and TV. Weekly, we provide our listeners with information, advice and knowledge to help people navigate a career in the entertainment industry.
Plus, we have fantastic guests from the world of entertainment who share their stories with us, where we learn from their experience of working in the entertainment business, built in with some fun facts along the way.
So be sure to subscribe on your favourite podcast platform.
You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google Podcasts, plus many others.
We look forward to welcoming you to the show.
We're excited to be back with Season 3. And the first guest on the show is Paul Duddridge, Hollywood director and former manager of Michael McIntyre and Rob Brydon. Paul has 30 years of experience in creating projects and careers of some of the biggest names in showbiz. He has worked with Hollywood legends including Susan Sarandon, Selma Blair, Christina Ricci and Sharon Stone. This chat will be made up of two parts over the next few weeks, so let's start with the first part of the conversation.
Thank you for joining us today on the Entertainment Engine. Today we have a really special guest all the way from Los Angeles, Paul Duddridge. Paul, how are you?
I'm so well. I'm so humbled to be invited on, and it's great to be here. And I've enjoyed listening to your podcast in the run up to this.
Because one of the things I wanted to ask you, I know obviously you're working with sort of Rob Brydon and Alistair McGowan and Michael McIntyre. I mean, just big personalities, Paul. I mean, a personal question for me, really, what does it take to manage those types of people? You must have been pulled here, there and everywhere, surely.
Well, yeah, I mean, you have to remember I was like, I was going to put myself down then, but I never really took it that seriously. So I fell into being a manager. And so I can't take the whole thing that seriously because I met, you know, Alistair McGowan was different. He already came to me when I was established, but I met Brydon and also Jupiter's actually, but McIntyre. I met them all sort of doing open spots or half spots. So, you know, it was much more my thing. The only thing I was really ever interested in was adding value to people. I couldn't take management seriously, like I said, because you go from one minute somebody who is, you know, completely unknown to then being dead famous. And my interest was how come those people are successful basically just telling jokes and standing on stage and those people aren't, you know? And so overall, that was my interest, was adding that little bit of value or taking away something that's masking whatever I thought their potential was, you know? The actual admin and the kind of sharp elbows and maneuvering of management never really interested me. Do you know what I mean? Because it's so I hired a load of people that just did all the paperwork, frankly. But then, you know, I came into it. This is a really long-winded way of answering, but I came into it as like a failed actor. And then I managed to land a thing at the BBC, and my friend basically came round to my flat one night in Ealing in like 1990, this was, and said, do you want to start a comedy club? Because we'd just been to one of the banana comedy clubs in Acton. So it was, it used to be called the Acton Banana, and the Ballon Banana still goes. But just fabulous comedy clubs. And came round to my flat next day, do you want to start a comedy club? And he'd been like the Ents officer for in Bolton. I think he was studying at Bolton, and he'd come back from university. And so we started this comedy club, and it now is it turned into Headliners in Chiswick, but it started as this thing we started in January 91, and it was called Ha Bloody Ha. So we started that, but to be honest, the first week we had 200 in, the second week there was hardly anybody in. You know, we were picking it up as we went along. So we sort of, I mean, like that Simon Randall, and he basically, I owe him my entire blagging life, really, because you know, he really got me, he got me going and gave me the, he introduced me to the culture of the comedy world, if you like.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but then I, after about 6 weeks of that, and it was kind of fits and starts, some nights would be busier than others and all that kind of stuff. You know, there wasn't enough meat on the bone for the both of us. And then just out of the blue, a comedian offered me, there's a comedy club that was called Soho Ho. And I think it's still called that. Anyway, and this was at the, I think it was the Crown, and Two Chairmen pub on Dean Street.
Yeah, I know.
In Soho.
Yeah.
And they had it on a Thursday night, basically. They had it on a Thursday night. This is really prosaic stuff, but they had it on a Thursday night. I didn't know anything from my elbow. And then it used to go about 8-10 people in, but I didn't really want to be a comic. And so the culture in the comedy clubs was like, look, I'll book you for my club if you'll book me in yours. You can come and play mine and I'll play your club. Yeah, and that was how the circuit was at the time. I didn't really want to do that because I didn't want to be a stand-up. And then I basically moved the club night to a Saturday and then used to just go through Time Out magazine and see who was on the Comedy Store, because they could do the Comedy Store early show and then run around to my club and get like 40, 50 quid during the break and then go back and do the late show. All right. So I was getting like Comedy Store bills coming to this little room above a pub. And within a few weeks, and then I changed the name to Comedy at Soho Ho. Because Time Out, which was the only real organ of the comedy world at the time, was alphabetical order, and that was it. So Soho Ho was way down the bottom and was empty. So I called it Comedy at Soho Ho, so it would be like the third club in the West in the listing. So that then turned into this little boom club of all the little clubs. Saturday night, changed the alphabetic order on it, and then suddenly a bunch of people, every Saturday night it was sold out, basically. It was like this really hot little club. But I used to get all the comics coming through, and then so people like the BBC would come down, because this was like 91, okay? And so we'd already had the alternative comedy boom from 79. And I didn't realize how lucky I was being part of this whole thing. So we'd had the alternative comedy boom. I had this club that was doing really well, and still signing on, stuff like that. Do you know what I mean? It was just so funny. It was just so funny. But to suddenly be involved in this thing. So I was the first person to get Harry Hill to compare, for instance. It was stupid things like this, you know?
Okay.
My birthday gig was like Harry Hill comparing Eddie Izzard and Mark Lamar. It was like this, you know, it was amazing to be around at that time and to be able to have these, you know, little clubs and do these things. But the BBC would come down because obviously enough producers knew there was something happening, and perhaps they'd missed out on one wave and another wave or whatever. And so I used to get the BBC coming down, and then somebody from the BBC, they used to come down and check out talent and all that. And so they started getting me to guest book on shows. And then just somebody asked me to fill in and sit on a panel for a quiz show pilot. And the host was Shane Ritchie, and we were talking during one of the breaks. He said, what do you do? And so I got a comedy club, and he was like, oh, can I come down? So he used to come down and sort of do new stuff. This was, again, when there was like an all-out war between mainstream and alternative comedians. So I always really liked mixing that up. But anyway, he was offered a children's morning show called Run the Risk, and we got along. And then basically, he asked me to write it and write the links and stuff for him. So I was basically at the BBC writing jokes with this comedy club on the side, and in the midst of it, comedians who were coming down to the club, I was kind of just asking them stupid questions, going, why do you do that joke that way? Why don't you put that at the end and put that in the middle and then blah, blah, blah. And when it started working, then a few of them started going, well, do you want to represent us? Do you want to represent, you know? And so that's how I got into management, was just giving people notes on their act and just curious why, you know, because I thought these people were geniuses. And then I found out that they were not, shall we say? So, and I just found that you could tinker with. So I was completely unknown. I was early 20s, completely unknown. But I found that, you know, all the, you know, the Avalons and the Off the Curbs, who were the big players in comedy, well, they were already pretty established in this space. The only way you could really get into the business and get any, I suppose they'd call it market share now, was taking pre-existing unsuccessful comedians or unsuccessful brands and just adding value. And I found I could add value by just slightly changing the performance and just making them a bit more user-friendly. And maybe I was really into a more of a mainstream sensibility early on. And so, yeah, so I would just give them advice. They would see some kind of result and then they asked me to represent them. And so I only did that comedy club for like a year, 18 months, something like that. And then pretty much by then I was a full-blown manager. And then the rest is absolutely untalked about.
Yeah, I think it sort of takes me back to when I started building festivals. There's a friend of mine that was sort of a sabbatical student at Kent University, and he phoned me up one day and said, "Oh, you work in the record industry, can you come and put together a summer ball for me for 5,000 people?" And I said, "But I know how to put a record in a shop. It's a bit more different to putting a festival together." And that was my first festival experience. And then you've got to learn. I think that's why also, Paul, it's really interesting to actually have you on the show, because I think it's really good to get management and agents' perspective. And I think that's one of the things I felt was really important, because funny enough, everyone I've had on the show or I talk to generally has never started by thinking, "I'm going to do that." So you've sort of fallen into doing what you do, and you've ended up managing, you know, some big acts over the time, and but you never planned to do that. And I always find that really sort of quite interesting, really.
No, exactly. Or particularly wanted to. That's the thing, you know. I'm inherently like just quite a lazy person, I think. And I tell you, the money you could make from like 1990 to 2000, I left England in 2007, but the money you could make was just stupid. It was just ridiculous. And there was no way a poorly educated idiot like me was ever going to get his hands on that amount of cash otherwise. So, you know, I was just really, really lucky. And as I said, I'm genuinely kind of humbled by it, because I'd had to get a proper job, and I've never had to have a proper job. And I'm just like, everything is to do, it's to do with Simon Randall headliners and then the just the comedy industry. It's been extraordinary. So I was so full of myself that I could just add a little bit of value here and there, that I, you know, I got myself into this mindset of just, I really liked the comedy industry and I really liked the comedians, and would stick up for them in the face of even if they really, really messed up. It wasn't adversity. It was like, it was more like they would be bloody minded and willful and think that they've got some kind of artistic integrity, when actually they're just rubbish, self-indulgent nonsense, you know? I just think if somebody's paying to go to a comedy club, I think you have to respect the fact they've probably worked. They've worked really hard to get the money to go to the comedy club. They don't want to see you having an existential crisis and trying to pass it off as art, you know, and then wondering why you're not getting booked on TV, you know? That's where I started, was being really kind of forgiving and accommodating to the acts, you know? And then I was writing this show, Run the Risk. And then the BBC, they brought in a co-writer on the thing, straight out of university on some sort of program or whatever. The producer had seen this kid's stuff, and that was David Walliams.
Okay, yeah.
So Walliams came in, and we did, you know, this one season of Run the Risk, and that was just surreal. And he was, you know, he's always been exactly the same, by the way. I mean, he's one of those people that, he was David Walliams when I met him, and his lifestyle was the same, and he was dating beautiful models when he was a complete unknown student. It was hilarious. Anyway, so Walliams came and then asked me to go and see his mate doing an open spot at the Comedy Store. All right, this was the thing. So this was like early to mid 90s, and I go to see Matt Lucas. I go to see Matt Lucas at the Comedy Store, and you know, he has a quiet one, but it's on reflection, it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. But at the time, my head was still in, what does the comedy circuit want? All right. And I don't think this is a big deal to Matt Lucas, but it's a big deal to me. But I, because he was Walliams' friend, he did this amazing act at the Comedy Store. This guy, he must have been 19, 20, something like that. And he had like, he was doing a Sir Bernard Chumley character.
Yeah.
Oh my God. But he was in the full tweeds and plus fours and stuff. But anyway.
yeah.
it was, you know, that was still, everybody was being really political and stuff, and he was doing this really funny, grotesque character, and it died, like, I can't say it died, it got quiet, okay, in the thing. So Walliams, his friend, I gave him a ride home, and I talked to him like he was some kind of, I don't know, like, I was really patronizing, basically, and I got it, you know, I was just like, mate, maybe this isn't for you, you know, maybe some acting, whatever, you could write, or whatever nonsense I was into at that time, yeah. You know, that this is the circuit, yeah. And the circuit works this way, and all this kind of crap. Yeah. Point was, Bob Mortimer saw him about 6 weeks later and stuck him on Shooting Stars.
Yeah.
So,
literally
about 6 weeks later, same thing, same act, everything, and Bob Mortimer, who is a genius, was right, saw him and went like, he's obviously a massive star. And that was great because I had to then stop kind of thinking that I knew anything. And it was just like, okay, I'm definitely missing something here because by any reckoning, this guy is a genius. And I looked at him really in a kind of very patronizing way, you know? And that changed my whole view of the business. And it's like, you know, that's when I started becoming, I mean, I don't have a lovely reputation amongst people. Most people don't like me because they will ask me what their act is like. And I you know, I'm not popular. Do you know what I mean? I'm not beloved because most of them have come to me. Most of them have come to me and gone like, will you represent me? And it's like, okay, well, I will, but will you change X, Y, and Z? And they won't. And I'm like, well, no, then, you know, and it's just like,
yeah.
People just want praise. And I'm very good at fixing people's personas, basically. That's kind of what I do. That's what I found I was doing in management. Yeah. And the point was, yeah. Matt Lucas had an amazing persona and I missed it because the act was off. But what it did generate was Bryden. So like I saw Bryden a couple of years later, yeah. And my headspace was completely different. Yeah. And he was, you know, he'd been going for 12 years without really any kind of career or credibility to speak of. But I saw him do an open spot contest and he didn't even win it. But he was the one person that, you know, you get on stage and I felt, you know, I don't look at the act anymore. I'm not looking at the content because you can always hire a writer. And it was just like, Bryden was on stage and I was just like, I think I know you from somewhere. And that's kind of enough for me. And then we talked off stage afterwards when he came down and I was just like, you know, if you're prepared to basically be ruthless and mercenary, there was one line he did, which I can't remember now, but there was one line he did that was kind of perfect and was really, really fitted his demeanor and really reinforced anticipation of what he was going to be like from his face, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
There was only one line he did, and I just said, look, if we take that as a cutting and just spread it throughout the act, that's your persona. And it was just like, I'll do that. And that was fine. So he was just really ambitious and really up for any kind of change. Because like I said, he'd had 12 years of trying to get going, yeah. And couldn't get anything moving at all. Yeah. But my approach, which is a bit more evil, was to cut and paste a piece of your most attractive personality and spread it right through the act. Instead of trying to sell jokes, you sell a persona. And the more you look at it, actually, that's always what's on sale is people's persona. It's the way... It's the singer, not the song. You know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And did you sort of write some shows with Rob as well?
I did, yeah, yeah. I created about three different series. I wrote and created and produced and directed. I mean, see, that's the thing. I don't come from management. So again, you know, people, you know, they don't like... How can I say? If you're an act, the minute you start getting a bit of status, it's a bit weird to be working with your agent, you know? But I'm not a dentist, you know what I mean? It's like, you can call me an agent. I'm just a bloke at a desk, you know what I mean? It's not like, yeah. I was just into getting them as famous as possible or as powerful as possible. So yeah, Bryden had done this fantastic thing, Marion and Jeff, that came out like just a few weeks before The Office. So for a few weeks, there were these things in the... It was like the Evening Standard wrote, is this the funniest man in Britain and stuff. This was all down to Coogan and Julia Davis, frankly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, Rob had been doing improv with Julia Davis. Julia Davis had sent tapes to Coogan because he was like going to open this production company, which is Baby Cow. But the first show out of that production company was Marion and Jeff, which had started with Rob and a producer called Hugo Blick. And they'd created this little thing. Again, because so they created this little show and they had this character, Keith Barrett. And I was just a lot more crass. So there was influences wanting to maybe keep Rob's work sort of small and insular and not sort of mainstream and kind of robust and populist, you know? And I'm just very, I like it all. You know what I mean? I can, you know, sit and watch an indie movie, but I want to see the Avengers as well,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Anyway, so basically, unless the muse descended, there wasn't going to be any more product necessarily coming out of Brighton because it wasn't all sort of insular and dark or whatever. And I just have, like, I'm like, strike while the iron's hot. So I came up with a show for the BBC where we turned the Keith Barrett character, because the, you know, the conceit of this, I don't know if you remember Marion and Jeff, but basically it's this cab driver whose wife has left him for a guy called Jeff. And, you know, he's very optimistic and upbeat about it, even though it's apparent that he's having a nervous breakdown as a result of leaving his wife and kids, you know. But he's trying to be very magnanimous, and that's kind of the whole sort of...
It rings a bell. I don't know if I've seen it, but it does ring a bell. Yeah.
It's a guy driving around in a car, basically. But it was at the very beginning of all those kind of mockumentary kind of things, those mockumentary shows. But like I said, The Office just trounced all before it, and quite rightly so. It's just genuine. That's one of the few bits of actual genius we've seen, you know. But it was... Marion and Jeff was very good. But it wasn't a juggernaut. And so I've just had an instinct that we have to get, you know, Brighton was the name. We have to get Rob's name in shows, and we have to make as many products as possible, because, you know, I'm a big believer in the sort of the Michael Caine approach. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just just take the, you know, I moved to Hollywood. I'm not going to do the impression, but I moved to Hollywood. I make three films. First film buys a house. Second film furnishes the house. Third film, I live on the money. Yeah. You know, I completely believe in that. That's where, and Bob, you know, Bob Dylan was doing albums with Starbucks. You know what I mean? So I'm like, I'm not precious about stuff. So it's like, look, strike while the iron's hot. Your heart, I don't want to wait around for somebody to be stroking their beard and coming up with some other difficult character comedy nonsense. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, we'll be able to do that as well, you know? And so, then I created, I can't remember which order it came in, but I created a thing called Director's Commentary, which for ITV. And it was crazy because it was like this kind of mad comedy thing. Our final episode actually beat the season, the whole show finale, whatever you call the actual finale of Frasier. We actually beat the final episode of Frasier. But it was such a little cult show. But in America, weirdly, when I actually came over to the States, I got a deal with Disney to sort of remake it, because, you know, it had this kind of, it was just, I took old episodes of Bonanza and then we just revoiced a fake director's commentary. It was a really cheap repurposing. But as you know, that was 15 years ago. Everybody's repurposing now, but I was sort of doing it, you know, 2004-05, you know, in the UK. So I did that with director's commentary, and then I turned the Keith character from Marion and Jeff, that's why I'm rambling on about it, I turned him into a chat show host, so we would get celebrity couples on, and they gave us like the BBC Two 10 o'clock slot. And that wasn't a comedy slot at the time. And then it became a comedy slot for like a decade and a half afterwards because of us, because we were hitting like 2.6 million at 10 o'clock on BBC Two, because we were getting mainstream guests like Eamon Holmes, etc. That kind of ilk, sticking them in this. And we had Richard and Judy, I think, for the first show, getting celebrity couples on, and they would be interviewed by Keith. And what we would do... So I didn't want to stop recording, for instance. I didn't want to give people the out. We had people like, I think Ronnie Corbett and his wife came on. So what we would do, and this is a thing we picked up in director's commentary, is that I'd have Rob would have an earpiece directly to me, and I would just be throwing in lines all the time. So that's how, you know, that's how we did it, basically. So, I mean, he's really, you know, he's obviously really, really bright and funny, but I was there in a little booth just throwing in gags or questions or sort of misdirections, etc., just to add to the whole thing. But we kept the whole show pretty much as live, and then just boiled it down in the edit instead of having tons of studio stops and starts, you know. Yeah. So the by the end of like 2 hours, you know, they would tell us their PIN number, you know. But that was called the Keith Barrett Show. That was just the Keith Barrett Show.
Yeah.
So that was director's commentary, and then the Keith Barrett Show, 2 seasons on BBC Two, and then I did this thing annually, Retentive, which was kind of the last show that I did in the UK, and that was just I was doing a lot of panel shows with artists and with clients and things, and they're just all rigged and they're all fake. You know, this was before all the BBC fake stuff.
Yeah.
And it used to, I'm like so right wing and so kind of anti the license fee and all this kind of stuff. I always have been.
Don't get me on that. I mean, I must admit, I just think there's so much choice with TV now, with Netflix, Amazon, you know, the BBC. I've had many conversations with people about this, and I think the license fee is doomed because there's so many other platforms coming out.
Well, I just think it's disgraceful. I think to criminalize. The reason I love me is that I used to say this at the BBC. So for those years, and I was making shows for them and stuff, everybody at the BBC, I've got to say, all the people, the commissioners and stuff, really, really nice. And giving me any kind of a break at all is beyond magnanimous, you know? But I did used to gripe every single opportunity that this is rigged. This whole thing is rigged. It's disgraceful that people are paying. And if they don't pay, they go to prison. It's like, that's what it was at the time. Yeah. I think they've taken the sentencing out. But that was the ultimate sentence. And so I had a real problem with the BBC. But anyway, I'd see all the panel shows, and then I'd be going to the panel shows with guests, you know, with my artists and stuff, and they're all just fake and rigged. And what gets me about that, I don't mind you having writers, but so much of what the panel shows in Britain try to engender is the idea that this is spontaneous. Yeah. And that's what really annoyed me about it. It's like, these aren't spontaneous. You're doing, you know, you're literally pre-rehearsed shtick, you know, and it's just like, you know, fake corpsing and all that. And I don't know why it bugs me, but I think it bugs me because perhaps you're forced to pay for it, and it's cynically selling you spontaneity, and it isn't. So from America, I could see, like, you know, a few years ago, the BBC was starting to have to answer questions, and so was ITV, about like just rigging everything and trying to sell us, you know, sell it back, charge us for it and then sell it back to us. Anyway, so I did this thing, and the first season I was pretty proud of, because the whole premise was like, no, everything in the backstage, I created a real panel show called Annually Retentive, which was the history-based panel show, you know, and hilarity supposed to ensue, you know. But we would just cut backstage. So just before every punchline, or before most punchlines, we would cut backstage and see people being handed the questions and, you know, see them rehearsing the spontaneity. So I did that, and I sort of had a free rein in the first season, and it actually did well. I mean, like, you know, we had sort of great reviews, and even, you know, the Sun said it was like, I think, the best comedy of the year or something, 2006. But then what happened was, like, it was such my sort of baby that, and it was the show that sort of broke Sharon Horgan as well. Yeah, you know, that she was the guest booker on it, basically. But the second season, I was starting to, anyway, too many people started getting involved in it. I was writing, directing the first one, and nobody had any expectations of it. It was like Duddridge's Folly or something, but it actually did quite well, you know? And so we got a second season, and that second season just turned into suddenly everybody wanting to put their 2 cents in, and instead of just leaving me alone. And I sort of kind of, that's when I sort of left the UK, really. I was just like, you know what? I'll just leave it, because I, you know, it was a particular gag for me, that Annually Retentive, and that was it. And so that's when I decided to leave. And so, yeah, I just sort of sold up and walked out and came here, basically. Initially, I only came for a 6-month vacation, but my business partners decided, because I'd decided to walk away from being an agent, that there was it was described as I was ousted in a boardroom coup from my own production company. So I didn't have anything to go back for. So I stayed, and that was pretty much it. I just came and got my green card and live here. Now I'm a citizen.
Well, I mean, it's just really interesting to look at people's history and what they've done. I think that's one of the reasons why we, you know, within lockdown, why we wanted to start the podcast, because I think it's just great to have conversations with people like yourself and other people we spoke to, because it's just sort of a bit like a time capsule, really. You're sort of what people have done. And I think that's, for me, that's really interesting.
I think what you're saying is you want to see me buried in the Blue Peter Garden.
And I also think, well, would you ever go back into management? I know you don't like it, but...
Never, no.
Do people approach you now or anything? Do they sort of pick up the phone and say, Paul?
They do, yeah. No, I get two... This is why it's refreshing to talk to you. And I get the two inquiries I get the most. It's usually newspapers or the equivalent. Will I turn Rob over or turn over McIntyre or whatever? Yeah. Will I spill? You know, and it's just like, no, I'm not going to do that. And the other is people ringing. You know, kind of people. I'm not even, how can I say, friendly with or whatever. Look, it just seems that there's a lot of money and opportunity has suddenly been sucked out of London. If you're not in the right cliques, you're probably not going to get a big deal.
Yeah.
And that wasn't the case when I was there. And like I say, because I had a reputation for adding a little bit of pixie dust to people, I'm getting a lot of people that, again, don't like me, which is pretty much everybody in my family. And so I get those two. Will you turn over Bryden and McIntyre? And the other one is, will you come back and represent me or do it from there or something? And it's just like, I just don't, like I said, I fell into it. And I just, the thing is, my ego is so big. It's why I do my own podcasts now. I do my own stuff. Is I would rather be, I think the expression is, I would rather be a... I'd rather be a poor master than a rich servant, you know? The trouble with management, I don't know if you feel this, but, you know, my ego is such that I kind of think, well, I did that. And the minute, you know, I'm not the lead singer of the band, you know what I mean? I'm not even the drummer, do you know what I mean? I'm like, you know, I'm perhaps the songwriter, you know, that's about it. And so it's like expecting... you know, a Meatloaf concert to end with Jim Steinman walking on stage. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, now this ain't your field. So I always liken it to my role in management was I'd be the architect of the building, and then when it was finished and open for business, I would become the janitor.
Yeah.
You know? And so I just think life's too short. I quit at 40 because I thought, well, I've got enough money, I can just sort of do whatever I like. And I was wrong. I spend money three times faster than I realized. So I had to go back and do something, basically. Yeah, no, seriously. I thought, I don't have any staff anymore. I don't have the offices in the West End. I don't have... Nah, completely wrong. It turns out I am really, really bad spending money. But it's been amazing. It's been such a blast in LA. I wouldn't go back to management. What I do, I mean, I sell coaching now. People, you know, so when they do ring up, will you manage me? I was like, no, you can pay me and I'll tell you what to do. And that's the thing. So I've turned it into that, basically. So I have a roster of people that, you know, pay me monthly retainers, and I just, they get to phone me whenever they like and I'll answer their question, but I'm not invested in them in the same way. So there's no kind of emotional angst anymore. It's not exhausting. It doesn't impinge on my family life. I've got young children and all that, and it's great. And so I get to sell the same skills. And it's interesting, actually, because it looked really weird me leaving London in 2007. It's just like, but now everybody, since the social media has blown up, you don't need agents and managers anymore. That paywall's gone. So your artists are directly contacting
everybody,
you know, are being directly contacted. Now, you might end up negotiating a deal, but they don't need you as a paywall anymore. So now suddenly people are coming back to Duddridge going like, how did you know this was happening? Or how did you know this was going to happen? I had no clue at all, but I just got lucky again, you know?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I had a band years ago, actually, and they're a really good punk band. And, worked them quite heavily and, you know, really good band, and they were doing some good stuff. But they turned around to me and said, oh, we're just going to walk into William Morris and CAA and get the agent. And I said, no, you're not. I said, look, I'm not going to have an argument with you about it.
Mm.
But, you know, you guys go and do what you're going to do. Good luck. But it's going to be really difficult. And they took it that I was being really negative. And I'd done it to several acts. And they phoned me up 3 months later and I said, oh, how are you doing, guys? Yeah, not too bad. Oh, you know that meeting we had at William Morris, weren't you? Well, the security showed us the door. I said, I'm not being funny, guys, but they don't care about you. They don't care. And I said, it's just got to understand that mechanic. And I think it is a really difficult one to get your head around. And what do you think the differences are, you living in LA? I lived in LA for a bit. How would you differentiate from LA to London? What would be the big thing for you?
I'll tell you what, I'd say, and again, we've never worked together before. These are truly spontaneous answers. I am literally this quick on my feet. What my recurring analysis of it is LA is the way people think London is, and London is the way they think LA is.
Yeah.
They pretend that in London, LA is like, oh, it's full of sharks, and they'll shake their hands and they'll take your jewelry and stuff. And it's like, I find that in London. London, nobody's handshake is worth a light. No contracts are worth a light. You can walk out of pretty much every contract in London, you know? In America, just contracts are really, really, I mean, an email is legally binding, which I find really a great framework to work within. So I find people here actually, you know, I'm probably about 20, 30 grand adrift here, just people that have kind of over the years just not lived up to their name, you know, or lived up to their promise. You know, and that's in 14, 15 years. So maybe it's $40 a week, basically, probably LA tax I pay. In Britain, it's just like people, like you just described that punk band and stuff. You know, I'm assuming they're British. They just, you know, they'll just walk out of anything. And so I had this early on. This is one of the things. And again, no disrespect to his memory at all, but one of the first shows I did with anybody was, I think it was Jupiter's, was on Gagtag, this thing Gagtag. And I think it was Bob Monkhouse was hosting, and this was early 90s.
Yeah.
And I just was in the green room, and I would go to the green room every night because blah, blah, blah. You're supposed to sit there and, you know, pretend to care. And Monkhouse's agent was there. It was a guy called Peter Pritchard, who was lovely, just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah.
Really, really nice guy. But he must have been in his 70s. And I'm going, this is like a Tuesday night in Shepherd's Bush. And you shouldn't be. This is like grim, you know? And so that really instilled in me, I can't do this for anything long term. You know, I mean, I was just never going to hang, because it's such a precarious, you are tied to that. It's a bit like that movie, Mr. Saturday Night. You're tied to this artist for the rest of your life. In Britain, not only are you tied to them for the rest of your life, it's very unlikely there's any kind of long tail. You know, the only times I've actually really been stung by people literally sort of reneging and lying and stuff has been with British artists. I've never had anything like that in LA. And yet the conceit is that LA is full of flakes and sharks. And it's like, it's not been my experience. I've found people, you know, people here have written a lot of big checks and, you know, supported a load of stuff I've done. Without any kind of dishonor at all. And that's the thing that surprised me. I actually find LA to be full of honorable people.
Yeah, I think that's actually quite refreshing as well, to be honest with you, Paul, because I think the world is, you know, it is difficult. Entertainment is difficult. And I think people just want to walk into it and think, oh, I'm going to be the next big star. And I'm going to walk onto stage and I'm going to get signed by the big label. And unfortunately, you know, it doesn't work like that. And especially, you know, what we've seen with live, with festivals and what's happened in the moment, you think it's just been really, really difficult. But I think, like you said, you highlighted earlier, you don't need a manager and an agent anymore because of what's going on in the world. Artists can actually create their own career. They can go and talk to anybody they want across the world. They just have to understand the business. Well, that's all for today's episode of The Entertainment Engine. And thanks for listening.
Join us again next week when we continue the conversation with Paul Dudridge. It would be great to have your feedback on the show, so please drop us a message at any time. We would love to hear from you.
So make sure you subscribe to the podcast on your favourite podcast platforms so you never miss an episode.
Thanks for listening to the show. And remember to all stay safe.
The Entertainment Engine.